We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. WILLPLEDGE.ORG. Now here's your program.
Good morning. This is Focus 580, hour number two of the show. My name's David Inge. We're glad to have you with us. The producers, Harriet Williamson, Martha Deal, Henry Freinas at the controls. That announcement that you just heard mentioned the Friends of WILL. Let me tell you who that is. They're people like you. They're people who not only listen to the station, they're not just our friends because they like us and they think that the programming is good. They are our friends because they help pay the bills. It is as simple as that. And over time, our federal support, our state support, that has declined. The only source of financial support we have that has grown over time is the listener support. It is so vital that we hear from as many people as we possibly can during this, our fall pledge campaign, because what we're doing is we're raising the money that will pay for programs next year. We've set a goal. And last time I checked, I think maybe we were about halfway. We'll be here throughout the day today and for a few hours tomorrow morning. And that should be it for fundraising on the radio for this fall. So there you see, it's so important that we get people to make that pledge by calling or by going online. You can make the decision how much you want to give. The important thing is that we can count you as a supporter of the station. We're hoping that we can hear from 300 new friends this fall. That is, people either who've never supported us or it's been a while. So we'd be happy to welcome you in or welcome you back. You can call 217-244-9455. That's the number to call to make a pledge. Or, if you'd rather, you can go online. And I think more and more people are doing their pledge that way, going to our pledge website, which is Will Pledge. And that's just like it sounds. W-I-L-L Pledge, all as one word, willpledge.org. Either way, what you're doing with your money is making sure that the news and the information and the conversations that we have on this show, stuff that you expect and you rely on, you want it to be there when you turn the radio on. With your contribution, you are making certain that it indeed will be there for the future. So we hope that you'll take the opportunity this morning to make that pledge. And it's something we want to say thanks for. This morning, in this part of Focus 580, we'll be talking about something that has become a real force in American popular culture, and that is The Simpsons. This fall, the show, The Simpsons, began its 21st season and became the longest-running comedy series in American television history. Along the way, the show has won 23 Emmys and the Peabody Award, and has become something that is firmly entrenched in the American mind. This morning, we'll be talking about the series and what it takes to do it, how it came to be. And our guest for the program is John Ortved. He is the author of a recently published book, which is an uncensored and unapproved history of The Simpsons. And the book is just out. It's The Simpsons, an Uncensored, Unauthorized History, and it's published by Faber and Faber. Our guest, John Ortved, grew up in Canada, in Toronto. He studied at McGill University, and he also worked at Vanity Fair, where he was an editorial associate. In fact, he wrote an article about The Simpsons for Vanity Fair, and that was his start in on this subject, and then he expanded it, taking the opportunity to talk to a lot of different people, people who would talk to him, who were associated with the show. So that's what we're doing here in this hour. Questions, by the way, are welcome. 333-9455 is the number to call if you have questions. No one will expect you to pledge. That'd be nice, but that's not required. 333-9455 and toll-free 800-222-9455. At any point here, your questions are welcome. Well, Mr. Ortved, hello.
Hello.
Thanks for talking with us.
Thanks, David.
We appreciate it. One can hardly, I think, overestimate just how significant, at least in terms of popular culture and its impact generally on television, this program has been. Perhaps for no other reason that an awful lot of people who worked on The Simpsons then went on to work on other television shows, both animated programs and those with live actors.
Absolutely. I mean, I think it's even greater than that, in that I think, I mean, one of the greatest contributions to, when we say contribution to pop culture, and I think that's only relevant if you think, you know, TV is important to pop culture, which I certainly do. But I think that after The Simpsons, it got much harder to make bad television. I think a lot of the shows we've seen don't just take their cue in terms of content. You can look at shows like Jon Stewart or Colbert or Arrested Development or Community, and I don't think they just took their cues from The Simpsons in terms of content, but I think they really, really raised the bar on what you were allowed to put on TV. I mean, there's still some inexplicable half-hour sitcoms that, you know, that cater to a very low denominator, but I think in general, what the mass media were willing to put out, the bar was raised on.
Yeah, it's my understanding that the people at the very top here associated with the show, and particularly I guess we're talking about James L. Brooks and Matt Groening, maybe also some people at Fox weren't entirely thrilled with the piece that you wrote for Vanity Fair, or with the idea that then that was going to be a book. And apparently the word went out to current and some past employees of the show asking them not to talk to you. What terrible secret did they think that you were going to reveal?
It seems so silly because we're talking about cartoon characters and we're talking about a very large brand here. And it's like any brand like Coca-Cola or Disney, where their valuation by the public is contingent on their image. And, you know, it's not that there's some horrible secret to dispel. No one was murdered, and I don't think there was a lot of cheating, lying, or stealing, or there wasn't very much. But I think that, you know, I think that they liked the myth that was out there about how the show came to be, and it was very digestible, and this book dispels that myth a little bit. It gives, sort of shares some credit with the writers, and especially the head writer, his name was Sam Simon, who, you know, I think really injected a lot of the brilliant comedy and character and emotion into the show that we came to love. I mean, I think Matt Groening's creation was the drawings that you saw on the Tracey Ullman show and then on The Simpsons. I mean, he really made the blueprint for that. But I think what people really love about The Simpsons and love about that world came from the writing, which I think Matt Groening was less involved with than people have the impression he was.
Yeah, it seems that indeed is the point that the book makes, is that if the extent to which the show was a success, and it certainly has been a big success, it was the product of a lot of people. A lot of people put their work and effort into it, and it certainly just wasn't a couple of people. It was a group of people.
It was definitely, and I actually just off, this is completely off topic, but when I was listening before I got on the phone with you, is one of your sponsors called the Great Impasta?
The Great Impasta is an Italian restaurant.
That is maybe the greatest, almost right out of The Simpsons, it's so smart. The Great Impasta, it's one of the best things I've ever heard.
Well, they've been in business here in our town for a long time, and the man who started the restaurant a long time ago was just a big fan of public radio, so that's how we got him as an underwriter. But it's been a local fixture for a long time. It seems like a natural sort of name for an Italian restaurant. Maybe somewhere else in the world or in the United States there are other great impastas, but this is the first one that I've ever come across.
Do they have like super clever, you know, names for the food on the menu?
No, not really. Well, actually, yes, come to think of it, they do indeed have some super clever names for the items on the menu. But it is, in other respects, a very nice, really sort of very friendly, small, family-style kind of place.
I'm into it.
Yeah, it's great. The show started, and I don't know how many people will remember this, the show started as a series of short segments that aired on the Tracey Ullman show. And I don't even know how many people remember that show. Tracey Ullman's very, very talented British comic actress who is, I think, sadly underexposed. And this was a program that was being produced by James Brooks, who's a very successful TV and movie producer. So he was doing the show for Fox, and he had this idea, apparently, that they were going to do some short animated segments that they were going to use for bumpers. they'd have their regular segments, then they'd have the Simpsons, then they'd go into commercial, mm-hmm. which seems like kind of a strange idea right on the face of it. What made him decide that he wanted to do this strange kind of animated segment in this show that had live actors?
Well, I think the Tracy Ullman show was a very novel thing, and this is the book talks about this a bit, where you know I think what produced the Simpsons was this confluence of very lucky and very smart. It's very smart people in very lucky circumstances, but Fox was a brand new network, and they were struggling, but they were also, because they were struggling, they were willing to take big risks. And, you know, they were desperate to have James L. Brooks produce a show for them because everything he touched at the time absolutely turned to gold. And his idea to do a show, he fell in love with the comedy of Tracy Ullman. He just thought she was a genius. And he wanted to do this weird kind of variety show in primetime with Tracy Ullman. And what they came up with was he and his executive producers, who were Ken Estin and Heidi Perlman and Tracy Ullman herself, they came up with this weird kind of skit show. And the problem with skits is they don't always work perfectly for timing, so they needed to fill out the time between when a skit ended and when a commercial began and when a commercial ended and they were ready to come back to the show. And they decided to put a cartoon in, and they looked at a number of things, and they actually tried, they tried out a couple different kinds of bumpers, and Matt Groening's just proved sort of the most popular in the end. But they tossed around all kinds of ideas. At one point, they wanted to do something with a talking bear, and they weren't really sure what to do. And Polly Platt, who had been the production designer on Terms of Endearment, as a gift to James Brooks, had brought him one of Matt Groening's, an original piece of Life in Hell, which was Matt Groening's cartoon that he was doing in the LA Weekly, and he loved it. It was called Life and Death in LA, Success and Failure in LA, I think, and both Success and Failure in the cartoon end up being the exact same thing, which is death. And Jim Brooks just loved this, and they talked to Matt about maybe doing a Life in Hell bumper, but Matt didn't want to give up his rights to Life in Hell, so they told him to come up with something else, and he did, and it was The Simpsons.
And that, it seems a little strange, though, that they'd pick somebody who was not, Matt Groening had not been involved in animation before. He was a print cartoonist, and why they would think of taking that and using that as a basis for something animated.
Well, I think that, you know, when you're doing 1 or 2 minute cartoons, they are not all that different than the panels you'll see in the Sunday Funnies. They're different. There's movement, and I mean, there might be some, you know, McLuhan-esque argument about hot and cold media, but I don't even know about that stuff. But I think when you're doing a 1 or 2 minute segment on a show, you don't need those strong narratives. You don't need the sense of narrative cohesion, the sense of character that you really need in a sitcom. And I think that's why when they came to make it its own show, they had to bring in a really special team of writers to make that jump. Because frankly, you know, Matt Groening couldn't do that. He's not a TV writer.
Something else that is that I want to have you talk about, the visual style of The Simpsons is very distinctive, and I think that, you know, it's something that gets your attention right away, both for the outlines of the characters, but also for the color, the way that they use color that just sort of jumps right out and kind of smacks you in the face. So you can see the approach to style coming out of Matt Groening and his drawings, but there were also some other people who really established the look of the characters and the general look of the show.
Absolutely. There's a small studio at the time in the mid-80s in Hollywood called Klasky Csupo, and it was started by this guy named Gábor Csupo, who came over from Hungary, sort of escaped from under the Iron Curtain. And he had run an animation studio in Hungary, and he came to L.A. and started doing commercials, and he worked for another famous animator named Ralph Bakshi. And one of the people he ended up working with was a woman named Georgie Palouse. And she is ultimately the one who came up with the colors for The Simpsons. And they actually, the way Klasky Csupo, they were a tiny little studio, and the way they got this big contract from Fox and Gracie Films, that's Jim Brooks' company, to draw the Simpsons shorts on Ullman, the way they got that contract is they said they'd give them the color for free. They essentially just they lowballed everybody else and just said, okay, well, we'll for the same price that everybody else is offering you these these bumpers. We'll do it and we'll give you the color. And this this Hungarian woman named Georgi Palouse came up with this brilliant color scheme, and I interviewed her, and she speaks in the book, and she speaks very eloquently about color. And she loves color, and that's why she made the family yellow, and sort of African-American people were purplish. And she has this idea that, you know, color, that you could really change the way people thought through these amazing bright colors. But at the end of the day, it's also just captivating. And Matt Groening, who is obviously a very smart guy, had the sense to look at this color palette that she was providing and see that it was really different and really appealing, and gave it his okay.
Yeah, and when the people at Fox, particularly when they saw it, what was their initial reaction?
Well, I don't think the people at Fox would have had sort of an editorial decision about that, because it was really, all those decisions were made by James Brooks's company, Gracie Films. And I think they and the network execs at Fox probably balked at it a little bit. But Jim Brooks really had the final say on anything creative, and Fox, there was no way Fox could overrule any of his creative decisions. So I think once Gracie Film was on board with the color and the style, Fox was default on board with it too.
Yeah, they say. I think that maybe also what I'm thinking about is that while the program turned out to be a huge success pretty much right out of the box, it seemed that there were a lot of doubts about the show before it aired.
It was very expensive and a big risk for them. I mean, Rupert Murdoch had some deep pockets, and you know, if Fox hadn't sailed on the Simpsons' wings, they would have found something else. But who can predict those things? But they had some pretty deep pockets. But the Simpsons was very expensive at the time, because James L. Brooks, being the powerful guy that he was, if he was going to produce a TV show for them, he wasn't going to do a pilot. You know, the normal situation is you have an idea for a show, you submit the script. They decide to produce it, they let you make a pilot. They give you X amount of dollars, and you make a pilot, and then if the pilot is successful, they give you money to make more. And because this was animation, and it would take, you know, 8 months to make a single episode, and James L. Brooks was not going to make one episode. Barry Diller, just who was head of Fox at the time, just wanted to make one special and see how it went. And James Brooks just said, absolutely not. You're either buying a whole season of shows, or you're getting nothing. And someone in the book, later on, you know, I talk about the cultural influence of The Simpsons and why, you know, there'll never be another show like The Simpsons. And one reason has to do with media dissemination and the Internet and the available options that there are for all of us to watch right now. There probably can never be a show that powerful or that watched again, if that sentence makes sense. Mm-hmm. But one of the reasons is because there's really no one with the amount of power in Hollywood to stand up to a big studio and say, listen, you're either buying a whole season or you're not getting it. No one has that kind of chutzpah anymore.
So what did it cost per episode to make a season of The Simpsons?
I don't have a definite number on that. From the people I talked to who remember, they said, you know, it was supposed to be, you know, $500,000 per episode, and then after all was said and done, it cost like $1 million an episode.
Now that's the kind of money that we expect to be spending on a drama series with live actors.
Yes, and it's also, you know, there's a story in the book about the time the first animation came back. When I say it came back, they had to send all the animation to Korea to be filled in. You know, they sent them a little blueprint of what the series should look like, what an episode should look like, and then in Korea they fill in all the drawing. Mm-hmm. In Korea they fill in all the blanks. And when the first episode came back, you know, they had sent it, you know, 6 months before. They had no idea what it was going to look like. And everybody went in to see it into this screening room at Gracie Films, like absolutely everybody. And you know, it was just a complete disaster, because there's this lag between when they wrote it and when they sent it off to Korea, where the interpretation could go anywhere, and the interpretation was not successful in this case. So they had to shelve that episode and come back to it later, and there was some real worry that this thing wasn't going to work.
We're talking this morning in this part of Focus 580 with John Ortved. He is the author of a newly published book that's titled The Simpsons, An Uncensored, Unauthorized History. He spent time talking with a lot of people who were involved in putting this program together, all the people that would talk to him, and he put it in the book. It kind of sprung from a similar kind of piece that he wrote for Vanity Fair, where he was an editorial associate. He's talking with us this morning by telephone. We're going to pause just a moment here on our conversation with John so we can talk some money. We were here just talking about how much it costs to produce a network series. Well, you know, public radio, we don't quite have that kind of budget, but it does cost money to produce the programming. And what we're doing here, what we do periodically, is we sit in front of the microphones and we say to listeners and say, okay, Yeah, we get some state money. Yeah, we get some federal money. But over time, you've certainly heard us talk about this, that funding has declined. The only growing source of funding we have is listeners. If you've made a contribution, we thank you. If not, this would be a great time to do it. You can call us. You can go online. We hope that you will. Here to kind of help me make the pitch is Dave Teal. He is a program director for WILL Television.
Hi, Dave. Good morning.
Hey.
And also longtime Simpsons fan.
I was sure that you were. I'm just sure that you would be. I know you. And this is the kind of guy who would be a big fan of the show. I know it.
Yeah. And no, I was very pleased that last night, I think for the first time in many, many years, they actually aired the Halloween episode before Halloween, which was a nice surprise. And, of course, you know, as you said, you know, we don't have those deep Rupert Murdoch pockets to dip into for our programming. Contributing listeners provide the most significant part of our operating funds. And, of course, when you listen to WILL AM 580, you hear news and information reporting that you come to expect from NPR stations, but you also listen for unexpected stories. And, of course, this morning, the history of The Simpsons. Unique, well, the conversation at least is unique to public radio, and you get perspectives and insights from AM 580 that you don't hear elsewhere. So we hope that you'll call in this morning with your pledge at 217-244-9455. Make that call, make that commitment so that we can continue to live up to your expectations and occasionally surprise you with something you may not have expected to hear on public radio. And this morning, the history of The Simpsons, 244-9455.
We hope that that's true. And, you know, I've been doing this show for quite a long time now, and what we try to do is put a lot of variety into it so that there's always going to be something different. And over the years, I've talked with a lot of people who've said, well, I heard that you were going to be talking about, you know, whatever it is, that particular topic, and I didn't really think it would interest me that much. But people started listening, and then we got them hooked. And often people have said, you know, I guess I didn't expect that to interest me, but it did. It turned out something about it really grabbed me. And I hope that that happens a lot with people, that something about the topic catches their interest, and it's good, and the conversation is good enough so that we hold on to folks who would not at the start have said, well, I'm not really particularly interested in, well, the Simpsons, for example.
Yeah, but, you know, of course, it has been a cultural touchstone for, what, 20 years?
Yeah,
and
a long time.
Really, you know, for an entire generation. So it's pretty amazing. We're glad to have the story this morning, and certainly glad to have your calls this morning at 244-9455 so that we can continue to make Focus 580 part of your every morning experience.
Yeah, okay, you can do that. You can call or you can go online. Go to willpledge.org and make your contribution. And we'll talk again with Dave in a little bit later. We're now at the midpoint of our program, and our guest is John Ortved, and his new book is The Simpsons, An Uncensored, Unauthorized History. Faber and Faber is the publisher, and the book is out in the bookstores now. And again, a question certainly welcome here on the show, 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. One of the things that, you know, we talked a little bit earlier about all of the people that contributed to the success of the program.
Mm-hmm.
And at the start of the series, James Brooks, the producer, brought in a guy that he had worked with several times, this fellow, and you mentioned his name, Sam Simon.
That's correct.
And he was on the show through four seasons, and then apparently he had a big falling out with Matt Groening, and he left. Fortunately, I guess for him, he kept a piece of the show, and he, to this day, earns big money off of the show, even though he's not involved with it anymore. What happened? What was the nature of this fight between these two guys?
Well, the Simpsons fans know that they've read in the press previously about this fight between Matt Groening and Sam Simon, and I got some good stuff in there in the book about them snapping at each other and then not talking to each other on the Simpsons in the Simpsons building, which is pretty funny stuff. But Sam Simon ultimately ended up leaving. Those were creative differences that melted into then differences over credit and then differences over money. I mean, once the show became a huge hit, there were lots of falling out over money. And one thing I learned when I started interviewing and asking questions about Gracie Films, about James L. Brooks' production company, is that people have a history of difficult negotiations with them. It's not people told me that it's not the easiest thing to negotiate a contract with that company. And from what I learned, from what I can gather, Sam Simon's negotiation with the company for his Simpsons deal was fraught with complications, so much so that even though he was the guy, you know, he was the executive producer on the whole first season, they didn't even get his deal signed before the first episodes aired. So those first episodes, which took off like a rocket ship and made the show, you know, the show was pretty much an instant hit. He was the executive producer, but he didn't have a deal yet. So when it came time to negotiate his deal, I don't have the exact date, but let's say by the second season, when the first season, or midway through the first, the Gracie Films was in the very unenviable position of negotiating with a guy who had produced a monster hit for them instead of a year before when they could have been negotiating with a guy who was going to be the producer on a very risky venture. And I think that that made his deal that much sweeter for him and really soured things between him and Gracie Films, which is a business and needs to make money like any business. And really, I think, and from my interviews, I think they resented giving away a big chunk of money to Sam Simon.
Yeah. And so how much money is he pulling down now, even though he's been off the show for, 16 years?
Oh, yeah. He left The Simpsons officially in the third season, though he seems to have been running things. He was still at Gracie Films then. He pretty much is responsible for all the episodes up until the first couple of the fifth season. And from what I can gather, he makes between $20 and $30 million a year from the show now. And he's still an executive producer on the show. He's still listed in the credits. About between $20 million and $30 million a year.
And what would you say were his particular contributions to the program?
I think his greatest contribution was he assembled the writing team that made all these brilliant shows that you know, really stand out during the first, second, third, and fourth seasons. And he found writing talent in places that other people just weren't looking. He discovered George Meyer, who's this brilliant Harvard guy who had run the Lampoon at Harvard but was off in the hills of Colorado writing this very funny and very strange comedy zine called Army Man. And he brought in George Meyer, and he brought in John Swartzwelder, who's a former ad man and a total enigma, who'd written for Saturday Night Live, he'd written for Letterman, and he was just this totally weird guy who, you know, I don't think anyone else would have thought to hire. And he brought in, you know, Mike Reiss and Al Jean, who were a great writing team, and he had the sense to bring over Jay Kogan and Wallace Wolodarski who were writing on the Tracy Ullman show. He just had this eye for talent that, you know, you can't necessarily quantify. It's some people just have it. And then he ran the room, and he was described to me, you know, Conan O'Brien told me that if he could make Sam Simon laugh, he was pretty excited. Sam is apparently a very funny guy and a great judge of comedy. And I think that having him at the front of the room just really raised the bar in terms of a joke anyone was going to pitch.
Yeah, you mentioned there one name an individual who was associated with the program and then went on to a bigger thing, is Conan O'Brien. Are there any other people who really stand out who you would say, here, these were people who cut their teeth on The Simpsons and then went on to do significant work after that?
Everyone who's gone through that room, for the most part, has gone and left that room, has gone on to do some pretty amazing things. I think Tim Long, who's a current producer there, told me that, you know, once you're at The Simpsons, where else do you go? I mean, they pay you very well. You're writing for the best show on TV. Why would you ever leave? Like, what are you going to do? Go write jokes for According to Jim? I mean, where do you go from The Simpsons? But, you know, Conan was there early and then left, and I think it's unfair to compare it to Conan because, frankly, who's more famous than Conan O'Brien? I mean, no one's more famous than Conan. And he really, you know, he is obviously a talented guy, not just in writing, and I think he is a talented writer, but he's a performer, and he's a storyteller, and he's a great interviewer. And he really had his own thing going on. If he hadn't done Late Night, he would have done something else. He would have had a different kind of series. He had worked at Saturday Night Live, and he and Lorne Michaels had been talking about doing something for a while. Conan would have done something else if he hadn't done, you know, Conan O'Brien's show. Other people, like Jay Kogan, went on to run. He left in about, I think, the fourth season, and he went on to run Frasier, which is earned just a record amount of Emmys. People went on to write for pretty much... I've got this chart that I'd like to draw on a piece of paper. It only really exists in my head. But really, every sitcom from the big ones like Friends and Seinfeld to the UPN sitcoms to That's So Raven, you can look at all of those shows, and the people running them or the people, top guys in the writing room, have some kind of Simpsons lineage.
Mm. Obviously, if it was easy to create a show that has this kind of impact and it's been this popular, we'd have more than one. But there is just the one. And I was really tickled in one section of the book to read about the fact that after The Simpsons was such a big success, then the other network said, oh, well, we have to have an animated comedy series too. We need our own animated sitcom. And they brought in some big guns and they spent a lot of money and they worked to develop a number of series. And they were all a disaster. They were all huge failures, and none of them lasted more than two or three episodes, and some of them didn't even get past the development stage.
I mean, my favorite one of those that didn't get past the development stage is the Jackie Bison Show,
yes,
which was a talking buffalo based on Jackie Gleason, and he had a talk show. I mean, it's so insane. I think now if you put it on YouTube, or if you put it on you just did those little 5-minute clips on College Humor or something, it would be a huge success because it's so nuts. But I mean, I think those failures are very interesting. Another one is Fish Police. They had Steven Spielberg producing like Fish Police. It was called Fish Noir. It was so dumb. But I mean, I think the producers for those shows, and they got big guns, Steven Bochco and Steven Spielberg and just big people involved. But I think none of those people and none of the producers and the execs involved in making those shows were focused on the originality that allowed The Simpsons to be such a great success. I mean, at the end of the day, I just don't think they had the writing talent. But none of them had that originality. They were all trying to do, a funny bastard version of Disney or a funny bastardized version of Looney Tunes. They weren't doing really their own thing. And I think if you look later at the big successes, South Park, Family Guy, Adult Swim, those shows are either hugely original, like I think South Park is, or so good at referring to the past and referring to their inspirations. You think of those Adult Swim shows that constantly mock Hanna-Barbera and even use their animation,
mm-hmm,
that are so hyper-referential and so postmodern that they're very much their own thing. And the failure of those shows is they were trying to make another family sitcom. They were trying to ape The Simpsons. They were trying to make another family sitcom that was going to sit at an 8 o'clock slot and was going to take all the viewers away from Cosby. And that was, dumb with a capital D, because that lightning was only going to strike once.
And then I do think that it points to one of the things about The Simpsons that maybe it contributes to its appeal, is that they started with a framework that people were familiar with and characters that people were familiar with, basic sort of stock sitcom characters like Homer, who, like a lot of sitcom dads, animated and live, is a descendant of Ralph Cramden. It all goes back to Ralph Cramden. So speaking of Jackie Bison, it all goes back to Ralph Cramden. But then starting with that framework, then right away they just warped it so that both people could both recognize the touchstone and yet appreciate where they were taking it and the direction that they were pushing it in, which probably pushed it more in the direction of present reality than those old stereotypes, certainly than those old stereotypes were.
Yeah, I think the really brilliant thing is that you recognize Homer, Mom, you recognize Mom and Dad and the bratty little kid. You recognize that stuff instantly, and this is Jim Brooks's, genius. That nobody knew how to make a sitcom better than Jim Brooks. But I think these writers, these crazy brilliant writers, were able to infuse this, this cynicism and this silliness and this imagination into these characters that no one had really seen before. And yeah, Homer is a bumbling dad. He's the bumbling dad you've seen on 1,000 shows, except that, he's also a complete alcoholic, completely slothful, abusive, but we end up laughing at all those things. You know, he asks at one point, the TV asks him, you know, are you on your third beer? Are you wasting your life? Are you on your third beer? And he looks at the TV and says, does whiskey count as beer? And that's so brilliant because, number one, you know, you shouldn't talk to the TV. You should not be in an involved communication with your television if you're a sane person. Also, you shouldn't be drinking whiskey in the morning. And to make something like that funny, you need someone animated like Homer. He needs to be a cartoon. But also, you need to believe that this is some semblance of a real person. And I think that that really speaks to the balance between Jim Brooks making a real family and a believable family, and the writers seeing the vein of Ralph Kramden and the vein of Bill Cosby and just turning that on its head to make Homer.
And it again, something that I keep coming back to is as outlandish as these characters are, people seem to find something in them that they can identify with to an amazing extent. And I guess one of the things that I think about, and you also write about this in the book, is people in New York City or other places going around wearing T-shirts, African-American people wearing T-shirts with Bart on them, Bart Simpson, but a black Bart Simpson, like Bart, black Bart, like Bart with dreadlocks,
mm-hmm.
and stuff like that. That character was so flexible, and there was something in it for a lot of people to identify with that they took it to that next sort of level.
Yeah, there's a really interesting article written by a New York Times writer whose name escapes me, but I quote it in the book, and I certainly say who it is in the book about the phenomenon of Black Bart and what this, you know, little white kid, or I guess he's yellow, little yellow kid, who, you know, is ultimately the creation of the Fox Corporation, how he ended up speaking to black youth in the late 80s and early 90s in the urban cores. And it's a phenomenon. It was a phenomenon, the Bart Simpson catching on, but that's one of the more remarkable passages. I just think that the universality of Bart is an amazing thing. But beyond that, I think Americans, you know, I think Americans and Canadians and North Americans, I should say, look at the show as, you know, this wonderful send-up of life and this wonderful satire of life. And they really send up institutions, and it's hypercritical, and it's silly and funny. And I think the rest of the world, the people I've spoken to in other countries, they see it much more as a satire of America. And I think it really is a successful send-up of America and of North American culture. And I think, speaking to Europeans who watch the show or South Americans, I think it's a really interesting perspective to see, yes, there's universality and there's death. I mean, people were knocking off Bart dolls down in Mexico and down in Brazil, but there's also some differences in that universality. And I think people see the criticisms of the show very differently depending on where they're coming from.
You've talked about the fact that one of the things that really made the show what it was good writing. So it's very strongly a writer's show. It is also, I think, very strongly an actor's show, which might seem to be a strange thing to say about a program that's animated, but the people who supply the voices really bring the characters to life. I know that you've talked to some of the people, some of the voice actors. What kind of things did they say about their role in the show?
Hank Azaria said something really interesting to me, and he said that, you know, they animate to the vocal performance, not the other way around. And it's true. They record, you know, they write the scripts, they record the voices, and then they start animating. And the actors they chose for this show are just fantastic. I mean, I mentioned Hank Azaria. He and Harry Shearer and Dan Castellaneta and Julie Kavner, I mean, they are just an amazing collection of actors. And, you know, I talked to Albert Brooks at one point, and he credited Dan Castellaneta it takes a lot of talent to stand on a soundstage and go back and forth with Albert Brooks. And Dan Castellaneta and his improv skills, he can do it. They would record 3-hour sessions of just him and Albert Brooks riffing. And if you're a student of comedy and the history of comedy, I mean, Albert Brooks is a master of the sport. And, you know, they found Dan Castellaneta up at Second City, so there's that vein there. And Hank Azaria he was in L.A. acting, and he's another guy who just, you know, often they'll write a character intended for a guest star, and then the guest star won't be able to do the won't be able to do the table read, which they do, but, you know, the rehearsal, essentially. And Hank Azaria will read their part. And they'll end up having Hank Azaria do the part because he's just so talented. And Hank Azaria is talented. You know, he does, I don't know if you've ever seen his series Huff. That was it was on 2004 on Showtime. It's a great series. And he's a great character actor. He's a great comedic actor. And I think, and he's done some dramatic stuff that's fantastic, too. And he does stage work.
Mm-hmm.
These are very, very talented people. And I think there's been a few news items sort of every 4 years or so when they renegotiate their contract. There are these news items about how much money they're making. And now they're getting, you know, upwards of $1 million an episode, which is a lot for a couple hours work a week. But over the 20 years they've done this show, and at the beginning they weren't making more than a few $100 an episode, for what they've contributed to the series and ultimately to the culture, I think they're perfectly valued now.
Yeah, it's...
Sorry, go ahead.
You know, I'm sorry. I was just going to say how in a way, though, how lucky they were that they had Dan and Julie, who supply the voices for Homer and Marge. They were cast members of the Tracy Ullman show, so they had them right there. So maybe that I don't know who would have supplied those voices. Now, of course, you can't imagine anybody else doing it. But who, if they hadn't had them to start out with, who they would have cast to do that?
You know, it's perhaps unfair that I give so much credit to the writers because, you know, and there could be a material factor there in that I didn't get to interview many of the actors, but I can't overemphasize how important those voices are. And I think, you know, I keep citing Dan Castellaneta, but I just can't imagine another actor doing what he did with Homer. And I think this is a simple example, but I think it says it all, that there is no dough on the strips. There is a stage direction that says annoyed grunt, and dough is something Dan Castellaneta came up with.
Mm.
He just came up with it on the spot. And, you know, those kind of improbabilities, a casting agent can't buy those.
Something else I'd want to have you talk about, one of the things that the show was known for is commenting on something that's happening now. It has a real sort of sense of currency that now shows like that, like South Park and like other shows, have to have.
Mm-hmm.
When you have a show like this, though, where there's this real long lag time between writing the show, they write the show, they record the parts, they send it out to be animated, and then the show comes back, how do you do that?
Well, I think that speaks originally to the brilliance of these writers and then later on to not any lack of brilliance, but maybe to their sloth, in that they really had to make the jokes timeless with this series. They really did, especially the first 7-8 seasons. There can't be a joke about, you know, they can't do what Saturday Night Live does. They can't make fun of what happened in the news last week. They can't even make fun of what happened in the news last year because it might not be important a year from then. And so their jokes really had to be timeless. The problem is after 10, 11 years of doing that, you can only do so much with a set of characters. I can't imagine the difficulties that room has coming up with new stories. And the fact is it just gets easier to write about trends. You know, last year or 2 years ago they had a gay marriage episode, and I think you just have to use it as a necessary crutch after a while to say, okay, you know what, American Idol has been on the air for 5 years now. Let's do an American Idol episode because it's going to be on the air 2 years. It's going to be on the air 2 years from now. We can make fun of this because this is now a genre we can pick. And, you know, they did the same with, you know, you can do that with gay marriage. You can pick up trends, celebrities and politics. And it's a crutch, but I think after a certain amount of years, it's a necessary crutch.
We have a caller here. I want to try to get in while we still have some time. Someone on our toll-free line calling from Orland Park, so we'll go right there. Line 4. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Interesting conversation. I wanted to find out, no mention was made yet as to the passing of Phil Hartman. Was there any consideration given to continuing some of the characters he portrayed on the show?
I don't believe there was. I was at a talk in Tribeca recently, and Mike Reese, who's a longtime writer and consultant on the show, was giving a talk. And the first question anyone asked when they opened up the floor to questions was, like, can you talk a bit about Phil Hartman and what he added to the show? And Mike Reese said very dryly, thank you for bringing up my dead friend. And I think it's, you know, Phil Hartman's death was a tragedy, and it was, and his character on the show, his characters, Lionel Hutz, especially, was a favorite of mine, and Troy McClure. It's like Dan Castellaneta doing Homer. Who else would you get to do those roles? I don't think they canceled those roles out of pure respect to Phil Hartman. I don't know who else would do them.
Okay. Thank you very much.
All right. We're coming down to just having a couple of minutes left. The show's been going on now more than two decades, and I think that and it still continues to be very popular, and I'm sure a lot of people sit there and it's an appointment for them, appointment viewing for them. At the same time, I think there are some people who would say that maybe the golden age of the show has passed, that maybe its peak was some years back. And it's hard to do a show like this. And it's hard to do it at that level for a very long time. You know, I don't know how long anybody can expect to be cutting edge. So that maybe invites a question: how many more years do you think they've got in them?
You know, I don't know. Matt Groening made a really interesting comment, not to me, but to an interviewer, where he said, you know, this thing runs on its own wheels now. He said if he got hit by a truck tomorrow, the show would just keep on going. And I think they really do have it down to a science, and I think almost to the show's detriment, where they can put these shows out like it's like their output from a factory. And I don't know when they'll end the show. I mean, I think the obvious answer is when it becomes unprofitable. And I think the show is so big now that, you know, the Simpsons movie was just the beginning. I think they have a brand on their hands that's as big as any brand TV has produced, and you know, they already have a Simpsons ride at Universal Studios. I can't see a problem. I can speculate that why not build a Simpsons world? This thing will move on, even if the show died tomorrow, which it won't. This thing will move on in another medium.
How much money has the show made to date?
No one really knows the answer to that. No one outside of News Corp does. When the actors were renegotiating in 2004, they hired a firm to investigate and get an estimate. And because this was the actors, you know, they were going after Fox and saying, look how much money we've made for you. This is probably the very high end. But this was a few years ago. This was 5 years ago, and they speculated it was $3
billion. Wow. That's a stunning amount of money.
It is. You know, I asked Rupert Murdoch that question when I interviewed him, and he just sort of leaned back in his chair and smiled and said, let's just say it's a lot.
And when Rupert Murdoch says something is a lot,
it's
a lot.
He knows what a lot of money is.
Yeah, exactly. I mentioned that this is an unauthorized book, and that initially that some of the folks there associated with the show and at Fox weren't real thrilled with the project. I think one guy, if you were going to write a book about The Simpsons, one guy you'd really want to talk to would be Matt Groening, and he wouldn't talk to you. If you could, what really would you want to know?
Well, having spent, I guess I'm almost at 3 years now doing from the beginning of the magazine article to this, to the book's publication, I'd want to know the most details. I wouldn't want to know what he thinks of the series, or, you know, I would want to ask him the questions that he's answered in other publications. I would want to know about the nitty-gritty fights with Sam Simon, and I would want to know, you know, exactly what he thinks about James L. Brooks, and, you know, Rupert Murdoch told me they can't stand each other, and I'd love to hear about that. And, you know, if I was going to ask him general questions, I would really like to know how he feels being, you know, a counterculture guy who was a real product of the 60s and was drawing this indie comic and, you know, has now is more or less responsible for this force that has made Fox, you know, so much money and in some ways contributed to Fox News, and I would love to see how he feels about his contribution to the world.
The book is The Simpsons, an uncensored, unauthorized history. It's just recently published by Faber & Faber by our guest, John Ortved. He was editorial associate at Vanity Fair, grew up in Canada, and has been spending some time with us this morning to talk about the book. So if you're into The Simpsons, it's a book that you'll want to take a look at. And John, thanks very much for talking with us.
Thank you, Dave.